Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Topping the news, a vigil held in Tokyo for Japanese journalist Kenji Goto, apparently beheaded by Islamic State extremists. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe called the killing an inhumane and contemptible act of terrorism. In Washington, President Barack Obama described the killing as heinous murder. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond offered his country's response to the killing.
We stand together with the people of Japan and indeed with all our allies against terrorism wherever it rears its heads. And I'd like to send my expression of sympathies to the family, the friends of Kenji Goto and indeed to the people of Japan.
Islamic State fighters facing Kurdish troops today, meantime, have acknowledged their defeat and retreat at the hands of the troops and the Allied air support from the Syrian key city of Kobani after months of fighting. At least seven Lebanese Shiite pilgrims were killed today in Damascus when a bomb exploded on a bus carrying them to the holy sites in the Syrian capital. Authorities said another 20 pilgrims were wounded in the attack in the center of Damascus. Syria's state news agency called the terrorist bombing, said it involved 5 kilograms of explosives placed near the front of the bus and that a second device was found on the floor of the bus. Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate, the Nusra Front, has claimed responsibility for the attack and accused the bus passengers of being Hezbollah fighters. Boko Haram fighters have renewed their attack on the Nigerian city of Maiduguri, killing at least 8, but they have now been repelled. There were loud explosions and gunfire heard throughout the northeastern city and capital of Borno State as the extremists attacked from 4 different roads, but again, they have now been pushed back by government soldiers. And a VOA reporter saw hundreds trying to help. This is VOA News. The International Organization for Migration is warning against growing violence targeting foreign nationals and other migrants in several Johannesburg townships. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The International Organization for Migration reports attacks against migrants have now spread beyond Soweto to 2 other Johannesburg townships, Alexandra and Langlakte. In the past 2 weeks, IOM reports 9 people have been killed in the affected areas, with 7 deaths directly linked to the violence between migrants and South Africans. Spokesman Joel Millman says there are more than 700 documented cases of looting of shops owned by migrants.
Prejudices and stereotypes about migrants unfortunately fuel the sentiments of those who choose to loot and plunder the shops of hardworking entrepreneurs simply because of their ethnic background.
The IOM says measures must be taken to protect their safety, property, and dignity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Egypt has deported an Al Jazeera journalist back to his native Australia today with word that a second journalist may be deported to Canada within days. Peter Grass left Cairo on a flight to Cyprus en route to Australia after Egypt's President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi approved his deportation. He had been imprisoned for 400 days as he was freed, and Egyptian security officials said a second Al Jazeera journalist arrested with him in December of 2013, Canadian-Egyptian Mohamed Fahmy, could be released and deported within days to Canada. The latest fighting in Ukraine comes one day after peace talks between Ukraine and pro-Russian separatists were held but adjourned after several hours. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
With rebel forces on 3 sides of Debaltseve, civilians were fleeing to the north on the one government-controlled road, still within range of rebel artillery. On Friday, Ukraine lost 15 troops, according to the defense minister, with 30 injured. Overnight, the rebel-held city of Donetsk took heavy shelling, with 1 death reported. In a VOA interview, the governor of the Donetsk region, Ukrainian Army General Alexander Kikhtenko, said at least 280,000 people have been displaced in his area since the rebels launched their offensive in early January, and that number grows larger every day. Al Pessin, VOA News, Kramatorsk, Ukraine.
2 bombs have damaged an electrical transformer outside an upscale shopping mall in Bangkok. This is the first such incident since Thailand's military took power last year. Police say the devices went off outside the Siam Paragon Mall, which has more than 270 stores. There have been no reports of injuries and no claim of responsibility so far. I'm Marty Johnson.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
مواجهة صعبة وقوية وشريرة.
He says that this confrontation is difficult, intense and bitter, and the struggle will be long and costly.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi orders the restructuring of the country's military command.
I do recognize that the challenges are great and that they would have been considerable even if we hadn't had this Ebola outbreak, which has turned out to be such a tragedy in West Africa.
The World Health Organization's new regional director for Africa vows to shake up the office and make it more responsive.
We are cautiously optimistic that there will be a resolution because when you look at the effect the immediate tax is going to have on the industry.
And Zambian new president Edgar Lungu faces a faltering economy. We'll have a report. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Following terror attacks against military targets in the northern Sinai several days ago, President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has ordered the restructuring of Egypt's military command structure east of the Suez Canal. An Egyptian court also declared the military wing of Hamas, which runs Gaza, a terror organization. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Egyptian military helicopters flew over Cairo Saturday as concern grew about terror groups that struck government security targets in the Sinai Thursday, causing numerous casualties. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi cut short a trip to attend an African Union summit in Addis Ababa and chaired a meeting of top military commanders Saturday. He unified the army's command structure in the Sinai to better deal with the current conflict. Addressing a crowd of armed forces personnel, Mr. Sisi insisted Egypt would win its battle against terrorism. He says that this confrontation is difficult, intense, and bitter, and the struggle will be long and costly for all Egyptians. He insists that the Egyptian army and police are everyone's children and that they are ready to sacrifice themselves for the nation and the region. The Egyptian leader pointed a finger of accusation at the now outlawed Muslim Brotherhood group while not naming it for the Sinai attacks. He says that Egypt knows who is supporting the terrorists and will go after them. He added the battle is against a dangerous secret group with enormous resources that is plotting, entrenched, ready, and active all over the world. The Muslim Brotherhood has repeatedly denied charges it is involved in terrorism. Other Arab countries, including Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, have also accused the group of terrorism. Paul Sullivan, who teaches at Georgetown University and who spent many years in Egypt, believes the Egyptian military is a major bulwark against terrorism in the Arab world and that it needs U.S. support in the Sinai.
This is an increasingly dangerous situation. The groups in the Sinai, some of them have signed up allegiance to the so-called Islamic State. My sense is Hamas is also involved with this. This is a war not just in Egypt. It's in Libya. It's in Syria. It could easily start up in Jordan. It could easily increase in Lebanon. It could easily move more into Turkey. It's in Iraq. It could move into Saudi Arabia. It's happening in Yemen. The wall against complete chaos in the region will be the Egyptian military, and we need to support them.
A top Hamas leader, Mahmoud Zahar, said on Al Arabiya TV that his group has never been involved in terrorism in the Sinai. An Egyptian court, meanwhile, declared Hamas military wing, the Azzedine Qassam Brigades, a terrorist organization Saturday. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Nigerians go to the polls in 2 weeks' time, and concerns of falling oil prices and the threat of an insurgency in the northeast by the militant group Boko Haram. Dr. Iman Shehu is the director of the International Institute of Journalism in the capital, Abuja. A veteran journalist and a publisher, Dr. Shehu is a very active leader of the Bring Back Our Girls movement, which has been struggling to get the more than 200 Chibok girls kidnapped by Boko Haram released. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in the Nigerian capital, Abuja, by phone for an update on the campaigns.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of expectation in the air. I think this is going to be clearly for the first time in the history of Nigeria a presidential election that's really going to be keenly contested. Because for the first time, I think the incumbent is facing a very organized opposition. And then there are very clear issues at stake. And so there's a lot of expectancy coming into the presidential elections in about 2 weeks' time.
It's unlike African politics for a ruling party like PDP to be literally fighting for its survival, fighting for its life.
It's actually, the reality is that the PDP is so clutching at the moment. It's like a drowning man that is clutching at everything. If you look at the trends of the campaign, currently there is a documentary which is airing, which is totally a disservice to the ethics of honest, issue-based campaigns. But this typifies the kind of desperation that is facing the PDP, which has been in power for 16 years, but has really not moved the country forward in the way it's supposed to move. Mm-hmm. And this is part of the anger that the average Nigerian is willing to express on February 14th. At the polls, and which is really scaring the incumbent government, despite the traditional incumbency factors that African governments are associated with.
Briefly, also address the issue of process. Is INEC prepared? Can it reach access all the areas of the country?
Well, it's unfortunate that in 4 years, INEC has still not been able to provide the permanent voters' cards to all those that are eligible in terms of having been on a previous list, and just they did that list now updated to a position where they have permanent voters' cards. So it's a troubling situation, but again, it's a reflection of the kind of institutional weaknesses we have in Nigeria, where organizations do not perform as and when due. Things are left to the last minute, and then we start doing what Nigerians call the fire brigade approach. But despite the seeming shortcoming of INEC, Nigerians are determined that elections must take place on February 14th. There must be no excuse. Even the insurgency must not be an excuse, because the government had an opportunity to stop the insurgency for the past 2 years, and he failed to do that, and instead the insurgency has become like a cancer, to the point that a major part of the country, about 20,000 square kilometers of the country, is in the hands of the insurgents. This itself is a failure of the government, and for the government to try to use that as an excuse is not acceptable to Nigerians. So a way must be found for elections to be held. If the elections cannot be held, this is under Boko Haram. Elections must be held in places that still are part of the sovereign nation called Nigeria.
Will this election have an impact, or could it affect the way the insurgency is going, regardless of whoever wins the election?
Let me say, for the Bring Back Our Girls campaign, whoever, regardless of who wins on February 14th, we have a responsibility as concerned citizens to ensure that every one of the 219 girls is accounted for. So whoever wins on February 14th must be held responsible to account for the 219 girls. And of course, the insurgency must also be tackled, which is what caused this abysmal security failure in Chibok that has become a national disgrace, and the current commander-in-chief has been absent when he is needed.
Dr. Imma Shehu is the director of the International Institute of Journalism. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Abuja. In his crusade to crush poverty, the Zambian new leader Edgar Lungu is following in the footsteps of populist President Michael Sata, who died in October. His lofty campaign pledges might have been enough to urge him to victory in the January poll, but with another election due in 18 months' time, his crusade might be all but impossible. Zambia's public finances are stretched to the limit, and its mainstay copper business is in turmoil. For VOA, Gillian Parker reports from the mines in the country's copper belt.
In Kitwe City, in the heart of Zambia's copper belt region, bustling South African supermarkets and restaurants attest to the heady days of a copper boom that this region has relished for the past decade. Copper demand flourished as emerging markets like China gobbled up the metal to make bridges, cars, and more or less anything that ran on electricity. Copper has enriched Zambia, employing 90,000 people and contributing 75% of Zambia's foreign exchange earnings and 13% of GDP. But its future is precarious, as China's slowing growth has caused copper prices to slide to a near six-year low. In Chibuluma Mine, 500 metres underground, Assistant Mine Manager Joseph Moya says mining companies will have to start cutting costs to make a profit.
The country actually depends on mining. It's the biggest taxpayer source of revenue is actually mining in Zambia. We need to actually do an extra mile. We have to put in a lot, because I would say we're actually surviving now. It's quite uncertain. Everyone is worried. I mean, we don't know what is next.
Meanwhile, disputes between the government and mining companies have compounded the problem. The government has accused the mining industry of tax avoidance, saying Zambia is losing $2 billion a year in revenue. In January, Zambia, which is Africa's second biggest copper producer, tripled open pit mining royalties to 20% and underground royalties from 6 to 8%. Jackson Sakamo, general manager of Chibuluma Mine and president of the Chamber of Mines, said the royalty hike could cost 12,000 jobs.
We are cautiously optimistic that there will be a resolution because when you look at the effect the immediate tax is going to have on the industry, it is very clear that this tax system is not sustainable.
Zambia's copper belt is the ruling party's stronghold, hosting the highest number of registered voters. Failure to cushion the province from the impacts of falling copper prices could be a fatal blow to the Patriotic Front. President Lungu beat his main rival by less than 2% in the recent election. Throughout his campaign, Mr. Lungu promised to fulfil late President Sata's populist policies. During his 3 years in administration, Mr. Sata spent billions of dollars on infrastructure, grain and fuel subsidies and salary increases for civil servants. But with Zambia's mainstay copper industry in a downturn, Mr. Lungu has the task of avoiding more government debt and reviving economic growth, currently flagging at 5.5%, the slowest pace in over a decade. Lusaka-based economist Oliver Sasa from Premier Consult says that the populist policies implemented under Mr. Sata are unsustainable.
The big challenge is that we are gradually getting into the debt trap, which actually might be injurious to the growth prospects. I think now the new president would realize that there are certain things that are better spoken, but that are not possible to undertake.
Others worry that the slim win has left the party vulnerable ahead of next year's national elections, which could tempt the new president to push through expensive policies to retain popularity. However, if Zambia's new president fails to rein in public spending and improve relations with the ailing copper industry, he could be a sitting duck when Zambians go to the polls again in late 2016. Gillian Parker for VOA News, Kitwe.
The World Health Organization's new regional director for Africa vows to shake up the office and make it more responsive and effective in dealing with traditional and newly emerging diseases. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Machidiso Moeti says being the first woman to hold this post is both a privilege and a challenge. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Dr. Machidiso Moeti, a public health veteran with more than 35 years of national and international experience under her belt, views her appointment with a mix of pleasure and clarity.
I am very happy and proud to be the first woman, but I also agree that it was overdue, in a sense. And yes, I'm very excited, and I'm looking forward to the opportunity. I do recognize that the challenges are great and that they would have been considerable even if we hadn't had this Ebola outbreak, which has turned out to be such a tragedy in West Africa.
As Ebola cases and deaths gathered pace, so did criticism of the sluggish reaction of WHO's Africa office. It was held partly responsible for the epidemic spiraling out of control. It was agreed that a new leader with a bolder vision of what had to be done was needed. Dr. Moeti does not flinch from the challenges ahead, but she does consider the task formidable. She says it is crucial to help Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea build robust healthcare systems as they emerge from the Ebola epidemic so they can withstand future shocks. She tells VOA these countries will need sustained support to help them recover. She says they will need help to strengthen their preparedness systems so they are able to respond quickly and effectively to future emergencies.
I hope that the outpouring of support that these countries have had can be sustained and that we can all play our part so that these three countries get supported, but also other countries in Africa get supported, because there are quite a significant number of countries with equally weak healthcare systems in the region.
She says one of her principal goals is to fast-track reforms in Africa. She says much has been learned from the failures and successes associated with the Ebola outbreak. So for her, a first order of business will be to structure and organize the size of the response teams and their skills. She says they must be able to react quickly and appropriately to emergencies as they arise. Dr. Moeti joined WHO's Africa Regional Office in 1999. She has served in various capacities, lastly as Deputy Regional Director. She knows its strengths and weaknesses. She will lead a staff of 2,400 in the 47-country Africa region. She says she considers herself to be a firm but fair boss. She says she supports an open environment that encourages her staff to be creative. But Dr. Moeti adds she expects people to deliver results and be accountable for their actions.
I'm a very fairly informal, open boss who is happy to chat and exchange with colleagues, but I'm very much expecting at the end of all that everybody will deliver. And if they don't, certainly a whip will crack.
Dr. Moeti says she will leave in the coming days for Brazzaville, where the Africa Regional Office is headquartered, to take up her job as director. She says there is so much to do, and she intends to hit the ground running. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Many topics were up in the air at this year's African Union Summit, among them literally air. For nearly three decades, African aviation officials have tried and failed to get the continental body to implement an agreement to make Africa one connected free airspace for civilian aircraft. Proponents say enacting this treaty will boost African airlines and provide much-needed transportation options for people across Africa. VOA's Anita Powell spoke to a man who wrote the book on this little-known treaty and why it matters.
African nations agreed in 1988 in Yamoussoukro, Ivory Coast, to create one vast free civilian airspace. Stretching from the mouth of the Nile to the Cape of Good Hope, from the Gulf of Guinea to the Horn of Africa. The so-called Yamoussoukro decision has since been written into law. but has yet to be actually implemented by all 44 African countries that adopted it. That has prompted some aviation industry figures, like the CEO of Ethiopian Airlines, to appeal to leaders at this year's African Union summit to push for wider compliance. Charles Schlumberger is the lead air transport specialist for the World Bank, and he is passionate about this treaty. He's also the author of Open Skies for Africa, Implementing the Yamoussoukro Decision. He spoke to VOA via Skype from Washington. He says the decision was made with good intentions.
20 years ago, it was seen that African carriers need to develop, need to compete, and basically it was decided to liberalize aviation throughout Africa.
Except after the ink dried, the open airspace never actually materialized. Most African nations continue to charge airlines to land. Schlumberger says many non-compliers are trying to protect their own, often fragile, state-run airlines. The few countries that have complied, like Ethiopia, have airlines that are competitive and successful in their own right. He also notes that many states that ignore the declaration have a financial motive.
And the major reason are landing fees. Landing fees are very expensive because airports are cash cows. So it is all about political will. But you don't hear that. You hear that we need to do studies up to competition. We need to have a competition regulation agency. We need to do more studies and workshops and travel and meet and make declarations.
He is a proponent of the treaty's implementation for many reasons. Among them, he says it would allow airlines to develop, it would bring in much-needed investment, and it would provide more choices for consumers. And he answered a question that has plagued African travelers for decades. Why on earth is it easier, and often far cheaper, to fly from one African city to another by transiting through Europe? Schlumberger's answer: Europe's airspace has been liberalized, making it cheaper for many airlines to take that route.
If we don't develop aviation in Africa through liberalization with the help of Yamoussoukro, European carriers will fly passengers from Lagos to Nairobi via London, and then they benefit. And you see so often, when I travel in Africa, same problem. It's quicker to fly over Paris, London, to another neighboring African country because they have not sufficient direct flights. But Yamoussoukro basically is an opportunity to develop domestic air services for African carriers.
For decades, this tantalizing possibility has hung over Africa's skies and may continue to do so for much longer. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here, only the best on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sport with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, February 1st. It's day 16 at the ongoing 2015 Africa Cup of Nations, and there are 7 more days to go in the continent's top football extravaganza. On Saturday, host Equatorial Guinea and the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DR Congo, became the first teams to reach the semifinals. Equatorial Guinea stunned Tunisia 2-1 in extra time play to advance, while DR Congo came from behind to beat Congo Brazzaville 4-2 in a battle of the Congos. Former Real Madrid winger Javier Balboa scored twice to give Equatorial Guinea victory in the port city of Bata. The quarterfinal winner came 12 minutes into extra time, when Balboa superbly called a free kick into the top corner of the Tunisian net. Ahmed Akaichi had put Tunisia ahead of 70 minutes with a close-range shot, and Balboa leveled in stoppage time via a penalty. The result was among the greatest upsets in the 58-year competition, with Tunisia 96 places above Equatorial Guinea in the FIFA World Rankings. In the first match of the day, DR Congo staged a stunning comeback to defeat Congo Brazzaville 4-2. Meanwhile, the Equatorial Guinean victory generated much debate about officiating, after Equatorial Guinea benefited from a hotly disputed penalty in the last minute of normal time. Mauritian referee Raj Sitton ruled that Ivan Bolado was fouled in the 98th minute, with Equatorial Guinea trailing 1-0. Sitton's highly contentious decision sparked fury from Tunisian players and the coaching staff on the sidelines. There were ugly confrontations between both camps near the dugouts, and riot police even moved in to restore order. After the final whistle, there was more trouble when the sides clashed again near the dugouts. The referee was surrounded by furious Tunisian players who chased him across the field and down the tunnel as riot police tried to escort him to safety. In post-match comments, Equatorial Guinea coach Esteban Becker said beating Tunisia is an achievement, almost a miracle. Tunisia played very well. They have players who played at a high level, while we only have one who plays in the top division in Europe, and that's Javier Balboa, the Argentine coach said. On Tunisia's angry reaction at full-time, Becker said he understands the Tunisians' anger at having lost because they had the potential to win by several goals. For his part, match-winning hero Balboa said, "The free kick was without doubt the goal of my life, for what it represents for the country and because it has taken us into the semi-finals." But Tunisian coach George Likens did not hide his disgust at the referee. He said the final result was false. "In all my 45 years in football, 15 as a player and 30 as a coach, I've never seen anything like it. Today's result was false. The referee has made a huge error," he said. Staying with the Nations Cup, the local organizing committee, LOC, for the ongoing tournament said Equatorial Guinea saved Africa's honor by stepping in to host the competition at the last minute. The LOC also said the tournament in the oil-rich country, which replaced Morocco in November, following the latter's withdrawal over Ebola fears, had been hitch-free so far, despite late venue changes for two of this weekend's quarterfinals. "We are proud that the Nations Cup was not staged outside Africa. It has been in Equatorial Guinea under the best conditions. We saved Africa's honor," said the head of the LOC, Francisco Pascual Obama Asue. The tournament may have been held in Qatar, had Equatorial Guinea not stepped in when it did. Asue said African football and youth are the winners. "We had only 50 days to prepare for this tournament, but we worked very hard, day and night," he said. Asue, who is also his country's sports minister, said he expects Equatorial Guinea to spend more than what was budgeted for the tournament, although he would not give any figures. In other news, these are not the best of times for President Sepp Blatter of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA. He was booed on Saturday when he made an appearance at the Asian Cup final in Sydney, Australia. The Swiss, who is expected to win a fifth term as FIFA president in May, was roundly jeered when he was introduced to the crowd at the trophy ceremony after Australia beat South Korea 2-1 in extra time. Many Australian soccer fans are still unhappy that their government-funded bid to host the 2022 World Cup received just one vote and lost out to Qatar. Finally, there is sadness in South Africa over the sudden death of legendary boxing promoter Cedric Kushner on Thursday in New York. Kushner was involved in many big-time world championship promotions around the world, including joint promotions with top South African promoter Rodney Burman. Among the fighters they promoted were Vuyani Bungu and Welcome Unsita, both world champions. Kushner was born in Cape Town, South Africa in 1949 and became a popular and highly respected promoter after moving to the United States. He handled the affair of top heavyweights such as Shannon Briggs, Oleg Maskev, Hashim Rahman, Corey Sanders, Chris Bird, and Jamil McLean, as well as many other outstanding fighters. Regarded as one of the leading promoters in the world during the 1990s and the early years of this century, Kushner was the first US-based promoter to receive the King Kong Boxing World Man of the Year Award in South Africa. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent.
Sizani sia zangu mimi zimeungua nataka aweza kunipata. Baby usizani siya zangu mimi zimeumbwa kuzaga.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Could this be the last hurrah for President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe? Last Friday, the 24th ordinary session of the Assembly of African Union Heads of State and Government, meeting in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, appointed President Mugabe as the new chairman of the 54-state African Union. He succeeds President Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz. The chairmanship is ceremonial on a rotation basis for 1 year. As is now becoming customary in Africa, some African NGOs protested the planned endorsement and cautioned the AU from going ahead with the appointment. Nevertheless, the Assembly did move forward with the appointment, and the loud applause that greeted the announcement was an indication that the AU exercised a proper judgment. President Mugabe has a share of critics and detractors at home and abroad. But it is quite remarkable that despite European sanctions, concerted efforts over the years to defeat him at the polls, he has prevailed. At 90 years, he has reached the top of the greasy poll. He represents the old-style African nationalist leader that fought persistently against colonialism, white minority rule, and all forms of racial discrimination. He was schooled by the great and famous Kwame Nkrumah, who piloted his country, Ghana, as the first African independent state in southern Africa. In contemporary Africa, President Mugabe is one of the few African heads of state and government who does not constantly look over his shoulder to find out what the outside world thinks about his conduct and behavior. Perhaps this might explain that despite much pressure, plodding by powerful states, the majority of African states have refused to throw him under the bus. Many may disagree with him on a number of issues and directions he has taken, yet they believe that at heart, he is an African nationalist. For many of these reasons, the appointment of President Mugabe as the AU chairman is a terrible nightmare. The many applause he received when he denounced colonialism and imperialism may suggest that with nothing to lose, President Mugabe would be relentless in confronting his critics and detractors. In his initial remarks upon his appointment, he urged the assembly to learn from the way he dealt with the land issue in Zimbabwe. But it was his decision to seize the land from white farmers that triggered the ire of the Western world. At the same time, President Mugabe made pronouncements on traditional themes. He asserted that, quote, during my tenure as chairman, I will deliberately provoke your thoughts to pay special attention to issues of infrastructure, value addition, agriculture, and climate change. This would suggest that President Mugabe may seek to be an activist chairman. It will be of considerable interest to determine how his many critics and detractors would react when Secretary General of the UN, Ban Ki-moon, intimated at the summit that African leaders should not stay too long in office, there was some quiet anger, as it was interpreted as criticism against President Mugabe. Some noted that President Mugabe had been elected by the people of Zimbabwe. Maybe there might be some surprises during President Mugabe's tenure. In 1997, when the then Organization of African Unity, OAU, convened in Harare, Zimbabwe, Sierra Leone, on the eve of that summit, experienced a military coup d'etat. After the new president, President Sitan Kaba, had been elected by democratic means, the then OAU made a departure by declaring for the first time that the continental institution would never accept any government brought about by unconstitutional means. And through the efforts of the OAU and ECOWAS, Sierra Leone was restored to constitutional rule in March 1998. Of course, there are those who will never reconcile with Robert Mugabe. For them, he will always remain the embodiment of all that is wrong with the African continent. Yet, for all those Africans who may perceive his faults, they know that he has become a legend, though a man of flesh and blood. For these Africans, it will be their constant hope that during his chairmanship, he would serve Africa forthrightly and with dignity. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America,
Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makolia, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, today will never come again. Be a blessing, be a friend, encourage someone, take time to care. Let your words heal and not wound. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 4 years since the civil war began in Syria, and sadly, civilians continue to suffer from the violence and destruction that devastated the country. Civilians already threatened by two vicious terrorist groups, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Nusra Front, also continued to be terrorized by their own government. Military units under the command of Bashar al-Assad target the civilian population, committing a range of crimes against the Syrian people, including murder, kidnapping, torture, and rape. The regime continues to imprison tens of thousands of individuals, many arbitrarily, and subjects many to torture, sexual violence, inhumane conditions, denial of fair trials, and execution, said Deputy Assistant Secretary of the Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Thomas Malia. It is difficult to accurately gauge how many civilians fill Assad's prisons, but documentation groups estimate that 215,000 persons have been detained, including 35,000 political prisoners. Many of them have been detained because they attempted to document abuses and organize their communities in defense of basic human rights. Even in the face of this continued onslaught, courageous Syrians continue their pursuit of peace, justice, and fundamental freedoms, and civil society and human rights defenders document abuses and violations committed by both the regime and armed groups, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Malia. This is crucial to the country's future because documentation of human rights abuses will be indispensable for the purposes of reparations, institutional reform, memorialization, evidence collection, and criminal accountability. The United States supports a number of initiatives focused on transitional justice and atrocity documentation, aimed at bolstering accountability for atrocities committed by all sides, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Malia. This includes the Syria Justice and Accountability Center, which engages in impartial documentation efforts through its database, analysis, training, and networks inside Syria. The United States will continue to support efforts to pursue a political solution that will result in a united, inclusive, and democratic Syria, said Deputy Assistant Secretary Malia. We will also continue to work with partners to end the atrocities and lay a foundation for justice and sustainable peace in Syria.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.